This is FNX.
Listen to Shoot the Defense. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Hello and welcome to Shoot the Defense on FNX in association with the D&D Footy Factory on Top FM and Travelling Peach. I'm your host Stel, and joining me is co-host of the D&D Footy Factory, Double D. Welcome back, mate. How you doing?
What's going on,
mate? All good, mate. All good. Great to have you on. Our guest this evening is none other than Glasgow Rangers, Liverpool, Aston Villa and England winger Mark Walters. Mark, welcome to the show. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah, I'm fine, thanks. Very good. Thanks for having me here.
Hey, it's an absolute pleasure. What do you make of Villa's season so far, by the way, Mark?
It started a little bit slow again. Last season was, in fact, probably worse, but this season a little bit better, but still, if they're looking to go automatically up, it's a bit of a slow start, because the budget they have, I think they should be trying to go for automatic.
Mm.
But with the slow start, it's looking a bit stroppy now, and a bit of pressure on to win the next home game, which is really important now because of the previous couple of losses. So, you know, that Sheffield Wednesday in about 10 days' time, and that has a big importance now. So to win that, then they're back in it.
Mm.
They're contending for the top two, but if they don't, then it's going to be uphill from there on, I think.
Are you happy with Steve Bruce, Mark?
He's got the experience, you'd have thought, to get Villa out. Obviously, he didn't do it last year. They had the biggest budget in the league last year, and some of the players that were bought didn't really hit the ground running, may I say. But he's got experience. He's got promotion before, so, you know, frankly, is there anybody better out there? I don't know, and that's the thing, really. I mean, if you're saying, all right, he's not good enough, then who else can do it at the minute, who Villa can afford? So
yeah,
it's the best that they can get, in my opinion. I can't see anybody out there with the experience and the knowledge of getting promotion and with a name as well behind him that's out there at the moment.
Yeah. I know.
Great stuff. Well, we mentioned Aston Villa because they were your first pro club, Mark, where you did your apprenticeship. Now, can you tell us about your youth career, and where did Villa spot you, and who actually brought you to the club?
Well, I live virtually about 1 kilometre away from the ground, and I always, you know, particularly evening games. The floodlights, AB was the shape of the floodlights back in the 70s when I was growing up, and me and my friends, we used to sneak into the ground, you know, 20 minutes before the game finished, we saw the gates, we used to jump in, and occasionally we'd be lucky enough to sneak underneath the turnstiles and get in even earlier than that. So it's always been my local club, and I've always supported them growing up, and it was always an ambition to be involved with Villa, and so that's how it started. And then it was a case of playing for my school, junior school team, and then when I was doing that, a team called Newtown Unity, who had a few players who were involved with Villa, or the manager was like a scout type thing, and I played for them, and I think I got invited eventually to one of the training sessions when I would have been about 9 or 10 years of age, and then you know, the rest of history is like, so I've done that, got involved with the youth teams and schoolboy forms and so forth, and then from there on we done well in the youth cups and that, and then I signed professional or youth forms, as they call it then, when I was about 16, 17, when I left school.
So that was what they called the YTS scheme, I believe, is that right?
That's correct, YTS forms it was. I mean, I did play in the reserves when I was 15, when I was still a schoolboy, which was real, real challenging for me at the time, because I was very skinny and small as a schoolboy, and all big grown men, you know, so I found that challenging, but it really worked well, and once I did that, I realised I had a good chance of becoming a professional or joining the club full time, and then you know, I got picked
Well, the thing is, I've spoken to quite a few ex-pros about the YTS scheme and about their going up the ranks, so to speak, and they were saying, you know, some of them clean boots, some of them clean the dressing room toilets, and then did a few odd jobs around the stadium and the training ground. Is that something that you got involved in?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, we used to have to stand behind the goals where the pros used to kick the balls into the cabbage patch fields, as we call them. We used to have to find balls behind the cabbage patches, and, you know, if we didn't find the correct amount of balls, we'd get in trouble, and had to clean boots and, you know, clean toilets. And we once a week, we had this thing they used to call the Blitzkrieg, which basically we had to virtually get toothbrushes and clean out all the mud out of the tiles on the dressing room floors. And it was we used to call it slavery at the time, you know what I mean? Because it wasn't nice. And, you know, we used to think, what's this got to do with being a professional footballer kind of thing? But it kept us grounded, really, and it made us obviously want to be or stop being by becoming pros, because once you became a pro, you didn't have to do it anymore. So it was you know, definitely grounding, because some of the lads, you know, coming from school and all of a sudden they're mixing with some big professional footballers, some famous names as well, and it can get a bit big-headed. So it was a definite leveler, and I would say I enjoyed it, but it definitely made me appreciate becoming a professional footballer when I didn't have to do it anymore. Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but did Ron Saunders give you your debut in 1982?
No, he'd been sacked about 6 months before that, because Dogenick became chairman again, I think, and after we won the league, I was still a schoolboy. Dogenick, I was still a first-year youth player, and Dogenick took over, and I think Ron Saunders was on a year-to-year contract, so every year that he was a rollover contract, and Doug didn't want him to continue that, so he left. So Ron Saunders left, and his assistant Tony Barton took over. And during that time, they were doing well in the European Cup, and I think they were in the final, if it weren't the final, semi-final, and they had a game against Leeds United. And that's when I made my debut, which we lost 3-1, but that was my first game for Villa.
So,
as a 17-year-old.
Yeah, so at 17, I mean, were you played because of the European game, the arresting players? Because I know that these days you tend to find clubs that are at that stage of the competition rest a lot of players, big players especially. Were you close to making that European Cup, or were you just thrown in to give a few players a bit of a break?
Well, I'd like to think it was because I was close to, you know, getting in the squad. But realistically, I think it was a case of resting players, because at that time it was a case of, if I played, for instance, instead of an older young pro, if you like, say someone who was in their 20s or late teens, if I'd have played against ahead of him, I think he would have been, you know, a transfer request going in kind of thing, because that's how it was back in those days.
Right.
So I believe it was a case of, they were just resting players, and I was lucky enough to get a game because of that. So, but, you know, I'd like to think I weren't too far away from the squad. And I was told, though, don't worry, you'll get your chance. But even as a 17-year-old, I knew that getting European Cup finals wasn't a normal thing, you know what I mean? I knew it wasn't going to happen every season kind of thing. Not at a club like Aston Villa. So I was actually very disappointed that I didn't make the squad. And, got it. And obviously, although we were underdogs, the fact that, you know, the experience you would have got from being involved in a European Cup final would have been immense. But I just had to put it down to one of those things and just knuckle down, and hopefully I said to myself, I'll make sure I'm in the squad next year kind of thing, or play next year, and that was my aim after that, really.
Well, it must have been an incredible experience, given the fact that, you know, Villa in a European Cup final, winning it, the atmosphere around the city, around the club, you know, players like Peter Withe, who obviously scored the winner. Must have been an incredible experience.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I was on tour with the youth team at the time. I mean, it was a case of me going with the first team to this European Cup final, or they sent me with the youth team to another tournament, and that's what happened. So I didn't even actually go to Rotterdam to watch the game. We were in another tournament in, I can't remember what country it was, but we were in another tournament, and we were all watching it in a bar after training, I think, if I remember right. So all the youth team were watching it there. And it was an unbelievable occasion where, you know, yeah, obviously, you know, we were playing Bayern Munich and we were underdogs. And, you know, we basically were under the cosh all game. I always remember that. And then, we got the winner. And, you know, the place erupted. We were all delighted with that. It was an amazing occasion. In fact, I remember speaking to Michael Rummenigge, who was on the bench in that game. And he said to me, he's never played or been involved in a game and been so on top and still lost. You know what I mean? So, even like, I think it was like 20 years, 25 years after that, he still was gutted about it. they lost the game. But it was fantastic for Villa, and obviously put us on the map as a club as well. And unfortunately, we didn't capitalise on that, but it was a great time for the lads. And, although I wasn't involved in the actual squad, as you say, the next season when we, although we didn't defend the Champions League, I think we got to a quarter final, which I was involved with against Juventus. It was just a great time to be around the club with the big European nights and, being one of the best teams in the league. And it was just a great time to be around the club, yeah.
And speaking of great times, you had an absolutely storming time at Glasgow Rangers. How did the move come about? Because I believe it was around about the back end of 1987 when it happened, so almost New Year's Eve when you signed on that dotted line.
Yeah, well, funny really. From coming from European champions and then the next year winning the Super Cup, although we didn't have a brilliant league campaign, I think we finished in the top six. From there on, really, the club really declined, as in we sold all our big players who were involved in that European Cup. And although we had a great youth team, because the youth team won the Youth Cup a few years before that, and all those lads were like late teens now, early 20s, and we had a good young squad there of players, but I think, in my opinion, we were just too young too inexperienced to do well in the league. And eventually we just deteriorated every year, and eventually got relegated that year. And I just wanted to be involved in winning things and stuff, and be involved in the type of stuff I was involved when I first joined the club. But I ended up going on a week-to-week contract, having not been able to agree a contract with the club, Doug Ellis and so forth. So it was just a case of biding my time and waiting for the right club. I nearly went to Italy and played for Pisa.
Oh, wow.
With Paul Elliott. Paul Elliott left and went to Pisa. And I was supposed to go with him, but unfortunately I got injured. I've done my shoulder, I think it was. And I was injured for most of that pre-season, so I didn't leave until the as you say, I think it was December, New Year's Eve time. And I spoke a few English clubs at the time, but we were out of Europe at the time, so which was one of my main aims. I wanted to play in Europe. The bonus of going to Glasgow was they were in the Europe Champions League still, or were involved, because Scottish teams weren't banned from the competition, and consequently it was either them or the reigning champions, Everton at the time. I think Everton had just won the league, and I was either at the choice between Everton and Glasgow Rangers. And what tipped it for me was the fact that Glasgow Rangers were going to be able to play in the European Cups that year. So that was the reason why I decided to go there.
Mm. And so you're a crowd favourite at Glasgow Rangers, even now that the fans still talk about you. You won three SPL titles on the bounce, two League Cups. Now, not a lot of Rangers fans actually point to that cross for Mark Hateley's goal against Aberdeen, which sealed the title in 91. Was that your favourite moment?
The club was just fantastic. They really did look after me and my family as well. And it was some good experiences all through the club, really. I mean, obviously that was a good thing, winning the league on the last game of the season. But I had some great moments, from scoring my first goal to just the way they treated me, from the tea lady all the way up to the chairman. They couldn't do enough for me and made me very welcome. At the time when I had a lot of pressure on me with other issues not to do with football. And it was just a great, great club, really. And, they did say at the time, once you play for Glasgow Rangers, you're always a Ranger, as it were, and you'll never forget the club. And it was totally true. They looked after me so well. I'll always be eternally grateful for the way the players, the club, and, as you say, the fans treated me. So, yeah, it was a good time.
Great stuff.
In general, was there any doubts? Because obviously not a lot of black players have played in Scotland before you went there. Was there any fear in leaving the family or anything like that?
Yeah, I was. You know, I've never left home. Although I had my own house and family, I was virtually living at my mother's house with my family. So I had my own house, but I was there most of the time. You know, probably only weekends I was only at my own house. So it was a bit fearful, as in going into the unknown. And although I was not scared football wise of what was going to happen, I was always obviously scared of living on my own for years, all those kind of things. So. It was a bit fearful, but I was just so determined to further my career. I just felt at the time it was stale, gone stale. I was probably too comfortable at Aston Villa. Everybody knew. The car virtually drove itself to the ground every day, and everybody knew me in the town. And I just needed to. I needed a challenge, really.
Yeah.
And no bigger challenge was playing in. For one of the best teams in Europe, with some great players like Ray Wilkins, Terry Butcher, Ellen McCoist, some great players I was going to join, and that was the incentive, really. So instead of me being comfortable at home with all my mates and family, I decided that it's a short career, and I need to have a big challenge, which was pushing myself, and certainly got that. Yeah.
Yeah. Were you close to? Ray Wilkins, obviously, Sandy Bost.
Yeah, well, we used to drive it together, yeah, because Ray, all the English guys in the squad basically lived in an area called Bodwell, which is like south side of Glasgow, if you like.
Okay.
And so me, him, Nigel Spackman, Richard Gough, who was although Scottish, he lived in that house in England a lot, so it was easy to get to England from that. Side of Glasgow as well, so that four of us used to go coming together. So yeah, very close to Ray, fantastic fella. He and his wife helped me settle in there. My house was close to his, and let me settle. Went over for dinner and so forth. And as I say, really helped me settle in. Which, as I say, was a real tough time for me at times there. But him and his wife, looked after us, and really sad to see him. Passed away at such a relatively early age, 16. That was no age really.
Yeah.
So I got him really because such a nice man, and even when he was at Villa, which is obviously close to me as I'm based in the Midlands, I went down and seen him and saw him coach a few sessions and that. And yeah, I really got him when I heard the news that he'd passed away. Yeah.
Yeah, sad. Well, that's sad. I didn't realise that he helped you a lot less sadly.
Yeah. Well, I've got to be honest with you, that was in his nature. I'm sure everybody who come across would say the same, because I've never heard anybody have a bad word for Ray,
Yeah,
lovely man,
Mark, you mentioned Terry Butcher and Richard Gough earlier. When you look at the defenders that are around these days, I can't think of that many leaders, people that will take the game by the scruff of the net. I'm thinking maybe Sergio Ramos is one of them. Terry Butcher and Richard Gough, having those two at the back, I mean, we know about that famous photograph of Terry Butcher with a crimson England shirt, blood coming from his head and everything, but how important was Richard Gough to Glasgow Rangers? Because he was a massive player, wasn't he?
Yeah. Again, he was not only good on the field, but good lad off the field. Great captain as well when his time came to captain the club. Because he led by example, as you say, he put his head where, you wouldn't put your boots, never mind. And he was really led by example. And he wouldn't actually do anything that he couldn't do, kind of thing, So he was a big player for us and, went on to, play hundreds of games for the club. And he's probably one of the best players ever to play for Glasgow Rangers. The best defenders ever to play for Glasgow Rangers, in my opinion. So, and Terry as well. Terry was a big leader as well when he was there. And they're vital because, whatever happened on the field, we were all in together. Say someone's getting bullied on the pitch, all the lads in the surroundings, or someone getting mistreated by the ref or whatever, he'd be the first one in to make sure everything goes our way, if you like, even if he probably was a bit too verbal, he'd just say it, tell you how it is.
Mm.
So he was a great player to have in the team and in the dressing room.
Fantastic. Well, look, before we move on to your next club, Mark, there's one thing that's I've always wanted to ask a former Glasgow Rangers player. Mo Johnson, I know that you received a lot of racial abuse while you were in Scotland, but Mo Johnson you know, joining Glasgow Rangers, being a Catholic. Can you explain the kind of abuse he received, especially at Celtic Park?
Yeah, in fact, it was quite funny because we used to joke, like, you know, say, oh, you took the pressure right off me now. Because, you know, like, I always get all the abuse, and then all of a sudden, I was getting letters and stuff in from the Ku Klux Klan and that, you know. And, but he got a bullet once I heard, you know, in the post. So, yeah, he definitely had it bad. I mean, I think they've obviously got a minder for him to make sure... he got to training or whatever safely, but yeah, it was, you know, I'm not gonna lie, we didn't go out together or anything like that, but he definitely was under a lot of pressure, and but he's football done the talk for him, you know. He scored a few goals, scored some important goals, and you know, without doubt, one of the best finishers I've ever played with. You know, he's really, really good player in my opinion.
Fantastic. Well, Graeme Souness came in for you as a Liverpool manager. He obviously knew what you were capable of, and you must have enjoyed playing alongside him or with him at Glasgow Rangers. What was he like off the pitch? As I remember several instances where, I don't know, how can we say, he kind of voiced his opinions to referees and the media?
Well, I like playing for him, mainly because I come from Aston Villa, where the team sometimes was picking itself, you know. I mean, some of the players in the Aston Villa team were basically picking the team, and I thought influencing the manager too much. Whereas when I went to Rangers, you know, it didn't matter who you were, if you were you just made your debut, 70-year-old debutant, or you were the captain of the team, you were the same rules as everybody else. And if you didn't play well, you wouldn't play the next game. And it didn't matter who you were, whereas where I come from at Villa, some players, regardless of who they were, would play regardless of their form, which obviously wasn't right. So it was refreshing for me to know that if you didn't play well, no matter who you were, you wouldn't automatically get a jersey just because you're the captain of the team, or you're an international. It was on merit. If you weren't playing well, you wouldn't play, and that's how I liked it, and that's how Graham ran his teams. You know, he was very. It could be abrasive, admittedly, but it was his way or the highway, basically. And the biggest or the most famous incident was with Graham Roberts, where, you know, I think Graham may even have signed a contract maybe 2-3 weeks before the incident, and he had a problem at a game. And Graham thought it was his fault, the goal that was conceded, and he thought it wasn't. And I think Graham Roberts might have said something like, well, if you think that, well, why don't you just take me off? And we all looked up, and that's what he did. He took him off, and seriously, I didn't see him again in the club.
Is a bit of trivia for non-Liverpool fans. You were actually the first player to score a Premier League goal for the club, and the first player to score a hat-trick for Liverpool in the Premier League. Now, aside from that, and scoring against United to prevent them from winning the league title in 92, and as a United fan, I've got to thank you for that, because my cousin ripped me to shreds that day. I was actually at his house, and yeah, cheers, Mark, you know. you and Marcus Gale got me beaten up when I was younger. That's another story, Marcus, but and he knows what I'm talking about. What would you say were your standout moments during your time at Liverpool?
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. You know, when you go to Liverpool or you play for these clubs, the aim is to win the league, you know. And when you don't win the league, everything else is just a secondary, really. But I had some good times there, but I had some bad ones as well, which is just football. But you know, getting through and we beat Auxerre in one of the European games as well. That was a good moment for me. Being the first Liverpool player to score a hat trick. Is a nice thing, but it's all tinged with disappointment because we didn't win the league. And when I went to Liverpool, that was the aim. You know, we're going to do well, myself, and hopefully be involved in the league. So, although I would never change anything, I've always been disappointed at the fact that we didn't do better. And ironically, they still haven't won the league to this day. But that was the aim when I went there in 91, to be involved in winning the league or being involved in some capacity there. And because it didn't work out, everything's been tinged with a bit of disappointment in my time at Liverpool. But I wouldn't change anything. I met some nice people there, and deteriorated slightly, in my opinion. Some of the young lads took advantage, you know, coming in late. I mean, I'm always a stickler for punctuality when you're in a group of lads like that. And, you know, lads were coming in late for training and bits and pieces, and I wasn't happy with that personally. So I was disappointed with the way the discipline side of things came about. But also, obviously, when Roy took over, I wasn't playing regularly either. So also, Royce was bad because Roy's a nice fella, you know. But the fact, you know, it doesn't matter how nice someone is, if you're not playing regularly, you're not going to be happy. And I wasn't happy because I wasn't playing regularly when Roy took over. So he's a nice fella, but you know, as I said, when you're not playing regularly, you're not happy with everybody. So I wasn't really happy with. It wasn't a happy time for me when Roy took over, if I'm honest.
Yeah, I can understand that.
I know a lot of people compared you to John Barnes. Did you pay much attention to these comparisons?
No, not absolutely not. John was a totally different player to me, although we played in similar positions at the time, especially in John's early career. But I think John's the best player I've ever played with. I think John's one of the best players in his era. You know, so I don't think I could compare myself to John at all. You know, so John was one of the best players at the time. Unfortunately, his England career didn't go as well as he wanted it to go. But I still believe he's one of his best players as a generation. So John was a great player, and more importantly, he's a fantastic man as well. He's a great man. He's a very, very generous man, and he does a lot of things that people don't see. So no, John was a class player and a class man.
You played alongside
with England. Are you surprised that you weren't capped more, considering how good you were?
What I would say, me playing in Scotland didn't help, and I know that for a fact because the manager at the time, Graham Taylor, told me that. You know, he did tell me me playing in Scotland is not going to help my career, my England career. But I always believe that although I was desperate to play for England, I just believe that your club football is more important. As in, if you're not happy playing for your club, then if you go somewhere and it doesn't work out, for instance, then you know, you just got yourself to blame. So I always believe if I played for England, it would be great. And but I never made it the most focal point of my career. You know, I always said, well, if I play, great. If I don't, it's just one of the things. But I did have John ahead of me, and Chris Waddle ahead of me, and even latterly, I suppose Steve Hodge played that area as well. And the lad, QPR, come a left sided player, can't remember his name now. But you know, there was a few ahead of me. However, me playing in a different league didn't help. When I came back to England, it may have improved things, but again, unfortunately, had other players to play against. So it was, I'm not going to lie, I'm just disappointed that I only played once for England. But you know, because I was fortunate enough to play in every level for England, from schoolboys right away up to the full level. So it would have been a great for me if I could have played some more. But there's better players than me that night even played the one time that I played for. So I just have to accept it and I just moved on, you know, it's one of the things.
Yeah. Did Graham ever come and watch you at all while you were at Rangers?
Yeah, Graham Taylor, yeah, I met him a couple of times after games, and that's when he told me. He said, playing in Scotland isn't going to help my career.
Oh, okay.
And I said, yeah, well, fair enough, but I was never going to move just for that reason. He's never going to move. I mean, I did move eventually, but it wasn't so I was going to play more for England. It was a case of, you know, one of the most successful things in British history coming for me, and I was like, yeah, this is going to improve my career. That was the reason I to make the move, not necessarily for England reasons, but for generally it was going to improve me as a player, I thought, and make me obviously a little thing like near at home. The Premier League had just started again as well, you know, with all the hype the Premier League was going to want to rejoin. So I thought, yeah, let's give it a go. So that was the reason why I moved.
Okay.
Mark, I look at the list of the players that you've played alongside, and you know, there are three standout players for me. you know, I look back and it's like these were absolutely superb players. Ali McCoys, Mark Haley and Ian Rush. Now, Haley and Rush had spells in Serie A while McCoys played all of his football in the UK and in Scotland. I know he briefly played for Sunderland when he was younger, but do you think he should have moved to the Premier League or even tried his luck abroad?
It depends how you look at it, really. I mean, he's a type of player that would score goals. He's given a chance, he would score goals. He's got that knack of just being in the right place at the right time. And with the right service, I really believe he would have done well in the Premier League or done well abroad. But he's, you know, it's hard to explain to anybody who doesn't come from Glasgow to understand what it means to players to play for the local club or, you know, the club that they've supported since a boy. And he could achieve everything he wanted at Glasgow Rangers. So from the outside, people may say, oh, well, he should have moved and blah, blah. But I can obviously understand why he wanted to stay at Glasgow Rangers for the entire career. Because, he, you know, financially, they dealt with everything that he could want. And, you know, the trophies as well. I'm sure he could have been involved in all nine of their nine in a row wins, in the, you know. And if not, he probably even won it even more than that. So, you know, I can understand why people might say, oh, he should have moved. But I can understand, knowing him as well as I do, why he stayed at the one club and, you know, made all those records. I think he must have scored the most goals, you know, for Rangers and so on and so forth. So he's broke a lot of records there. You know, he's even been able to manage the club, you know, so I can understand why he stayed.
Yeah, and him and Haley had that fantastic partnership. They even masterminded that win against Leeds in the European Cup, the Battle of Britain, as they called it at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well,
I mean, yeah, a great club. There's a great team together. In fact, when I went back up to, they teased me about it because I left the season before. For that reason, it's because one of the reasons was we weren't doing well enough in Europe, and I thought going to Liverpool would help that. So for them to the next season to get to the semi-finals, you know, they take the piss a bit when I went up and went out a few nights out with them, you know. But that's the way it is. Football's a funny game, you know. It's you think yeah, you know, you're going to do well this year in this competition, and then one bad mistake and you're out of the competition. So just one of those things, yeah. But they were a great partnership. Scored a lot of goals together, and been a good friends off the field as well, so, which helps as well.
Superb. Now, another, after retiring, you went back to Aston Villa in a coaching capacity. What was that experience like? Because you're coming from playing regularly to actually being behind the scenes coaching. I actually understand you helped develop Gabriel Bonhoeffer. Is that true?
No, I helped coach him. I've coached him a few times when I was there in the academy and that. But, you know, the one thing about Aston Villa, they have a good youth setup, and from even my days as a youth player, they've always produced a lot of players who got to play in the first team. So I definitely couldn't take all the glory for
that. Why not? But, you should.
But I mean, if I was doing it full time, I would. But I was just an academy coach, you coach part time, as it were. So yeah, you know, obviously, I like thinking took on board. I've got a few things I've said, but there's a few players I've coached there who made it, who got into the first team. Craig Gardner, coached him a few times, he's got the first team, and in fact the last team I coached at Villa, Grealish was in the team, the last team I actually ran at Villa before I left. So, but as I said, they've got such a good youth set up that, you know, every year there's somebody coming through and there's somebody taking coaching them, so they just seem to do well. I mean, I don't know why that is, but they do well with their young players at Villa.
Fantastic. Now, I know your book, Winging It, the Mark Waters story, is due for release next month. This isn't a typical autobiography, is it? I know you touch on many issues that have affected the game for years, such as racism, sexual exploitation by players, by a coach, physical abuse from fans. Was it difficult to open up about these subjects, or were you simply waiting for the right time to do so?
I'll be honest with you, not really. I mean, the book goes into a lot of bits of what I've experienced in my life, and, you know, from the family to the football thing, but it wasn't difficult, really. I mean, I said I've been asked to write a book a few times, but it's just a case of I just thought it was the right time to just to do it, really. I mean, we talked about Ray earlier, Ray Wilkins, and like Cyril was a good inspirational figure to me as well. Cyril Regis, and another friend of mine, Neil Cooper, who I played with at Aston Villa and Glasgow Rangers. In the last 6 months, they've all passed away, you know? So you're just the right time. You know? I just thought it was the right time to say these things. I mean, the guy who wrote with me, Jeff, said people will be interested in reading about it. So I just thought, yeah, just do it now, really. So it wasn't a hard thing to say. I mean, these things have happened, and, you know, the coach who sexually exploited a player in the team, and that is just one of those things that needed to be said. It's in the news a lot at the moment as well, so that's why it's funny, really. All these things affect me. For instance, when my son was growing up, I always made sure I went to his games and met the managers and made sure that everything was perfect. So that makes sure that, you know, nothing was going on in that team. So all these things do influence your life and do influence what you think about things. So yeah, so it's the right time to say it.
Yeah, because I know that you mentioned Ted Langford in the book, and your former teammate Paul Stewart at Liverpool. You know, I know that he suffered sexual abuse as a youngster, and he wrote a book about it and his experiences. As you said, it's happening more and more these days. We're hearing more about it, but it's very difficult to counter it. And you as a parent know you can only be there so much for your child. It's very difficult for coaches these days. I know I've spoken to a few coaches that coach throughout the UK and in America, and even they're saying, look, we haven't done anything wrong, but people are looking at us in the wrong way because of all of these things. It's very difficult at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I didn't open up a coaching academy, if you like, because a few people have to do it. Because I just think it's impossible to know everything about a person and what their lifestyle is. Even when those CBR checks have been done, even those are just relevant to the time. I mean, what happens if they do it after you've been checked? You know what I mean?
So,
it's a difficult one, and it doesn't happen. And all I think it's supposed to be spoken about, as opposed to all these things brushed under the carpet, because when parents are aware of it, I mean, the coaching I did with the FA, parents used to just leave their children with the coaches and then go shopping or whatever. And they were leaving with people they didn't even know, and I just couldn't understand how they could do that until they checked that they were fine and everything was, you know. So those little things, and hopefully they're aware of it. Parents are aware that everybody's as nice as they think they are, and as long as that's the case, then these things will happen less, because it can affect children and it can ruin their lives sometimes. And, you know, so I think it's best that people talk about it and make them aware that some of these people do levitate towards, you know, working with children, because that's the way they feel they can get their trust, if you like. So as long as parents are aware of this and obviously can do a lot about stopping it, if you like, then every lesson's been learned then.
Absolutely. Well, with the stories that you have in your book, I'm sure a lot of people can learn from them and take bits from your experience. I know that Cyril Regis was a massive influence in your life and many other footballers. He's a massive loss, isn't he?
Yeah, it was, really. I mean, I was speaking to him, you know, 2 weeks before he passed away, you know, and he looked fantastic. So, you know, for him to just pass away like the way he did, it was a big shock to people like myself who saw him relatively regularly. So, you know, if we had people like Sewell, I would never even try to be a professional footballer. I remember watching him, I probably was about 12 years of age, watching him play Aston Villa and what he went through and the abuse he was getting on and how he was dealing with it by not fighting with the players or going into the crowd, but just by playing well and scoring goals. And I thought, well, that's the way to deal with it. And when it happened to me, that I always thought of people like him who dealt with it that way, because that's the best way to deal with it, not end up getting sent off for jumping in the crowd, giving them karate kicks and whatever. The past, you know what I mean? So it was very inspirational to me, and it's a sad loss, because he again went and passed early, relatively early. I think it was about 59 or something. So very, very. I got it that he passed away, because he, in fact, the last advice be an agent, and I explained the situation and what they'd offered me, and he just told me, Mark, don't do it, because all they're doing is just wanting you to get into the clubs, as it were, and just using you, really. And he said to me, I know you're desperate to get back into football, but they're just taking the mickey out of you, really. Mm-hmm. Don't do it. And if it wasn't for him, I probably would have done it, and you know, wasted 4, 5, 6 months of my time until I realised what was going on. So yeah, it was very special for me, and so it's a sad loss, and got it for him, not only him obviously, and his family as well. His family really, really disappointed, you know. So yeah, condolences to them.
Really, just in regards, obviously, line, Mark, with Dad and Cyril Gaver, did you ever at any point strongly consider managing for an option for you?
Managing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to manage. I've sent up numerous CVs to clubs, not for a while, admittedly, but numerous CVs, and some of them didn't even get answered back, you know. So I tried many times to get into club, but it's the old adage, it's who you know, not what you know, and unfortunately, the friends that I know do not want to be a manager or involved in it. It is a ball ache half the time, I'm not going to lie, but I was desperate to get in. I really wanted to coach and manage, but I ended up there. I realised it just wasn't going to be, because I was coaching for the FA, and that's Aston Villa obviously as well, but I couldn't get a full time job at Aston Villa, and the FA job was a case of, I was coaching kids who were enthusiastic and wanted to be there, but they were never going to be professional footballers, you know what I mean? They were never going to be at that level where I played at, which is ultimately, that was my goal. I wanted to coach, once I've learned the trade, if you like, once I've learned how to coach and so forth, to coach players who were going to be young pros at a Premier League club, or actually maybe even coach in the Premier League. That was the ambition. So so unfortunately, it just wasn't to be. I haven't shut the door on that. And obviously, if someone come up with a right job, even now, I would take it. But as for me starting at the bottom again, I don't think I could do that now.
Could do that, yeah. I hear that, given your age and whatnot. But yeah, I hear that.
Fantastic. Well, Mark, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Your book is available on the 1st of October, but you can pre-order it on Amazon. You must be very excited about it.
Yeah, I am actually. Yeah, I mean, as I said, I'm normally a very, I won't say introverted, but I'm an outgoing guy, and everybody knows my business. And I was always at nightclubs and all. I was never that type of person, but you know, it's been really good for me to open up about the book, and it's very cathartic for me to mention some things that I haven't suppressed, but you know, to talk openly about them. It's been good for me, and I'm looking forward to promoting the book, and hopefully it does well. I mean, in fact, it'd be a bonus if it does well, really, if I'm honest. I mean, if it does well, obviously, I don't want it to fail, but if it does well, it'd be a real bonus, because I've really put my heart and soul into it, and I'm going to do my best to promote it, and hopefully it does do well. Now, at the time, I was like, all right, get it out there, fine, let anybody read it, but now I'm hoping that it does well, and people see the side of me that they probably wouldn't have known otherwise.
I'm sure it will do very well, mate, given your experience, given your stories. You know, just reading the synopsis on Amazon is absolutely fantastic, and I really wish you well, and hopefully you can come back on the show next time, or sometime when you're free.
It's been great doing it. You've got the details now, so just give me a shout, and we'll have a chat again, definitely.
Fantastic, brilliant. Well, guys, that was the excellent Mark Waters. Again, visit amazon.co.uk, and you can pre-order his book, Winging It, from the 1st of October. In fact, you can pre-order it now, but you can buy it from the 1st of October. So that's it from us. If you're still listening, we're on Shoot the Defence, on Twitter, at Shoot the Defence. Please follow our guys, our friends over at the D&D Footy Factory. D, do you want to remind us what the Twitter at is?
The Twitter handle for the show is at DD Footy Factory_, and we air on a Saturday morning at 10 a.m. on ontopfm.net. That's 95.5 FM in London.
Fantastic. And that's us done for this week. Until next time, take care.